Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am thrilled to invite you to Rachel Uncensored, my podcast where I get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. From personal stories to hot button issues, we cover it all. New episodes drop every Wednesday, so make sure you tune in on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.
Hello and welcome to the IGN UK podcast. I am Chris. This week I'm joined by Gavin. And we are spoiling you yet again because we have another guest. And it's a really good one this week. It's a gentleman called Gary Witter.
Hello.
Hello, Gary. Gary Hello. Is a games journalist turned screenwriter, turned comic book writer, turned game writer, turned book writer.
Now I do a lot of turning, yeah. Apparently.
Yeah. Well, you've done it all, though.
I've done a bit.
Yeah,
a fair bit.
It's impressive.
I'm quite old, so I've had time to do lots of things.
And you're also pretty much the perfect guest because those are all the subjects we cover on this podcast.
Yeah, I know. I'm like the IGN. Like if you built like an IGN podcast robot,
yeah, it'd be you.
Be kind of like me, I suppose.
If we were in America, you'd be the MVP.
I like that.
And yeah. you now live in America.
IGN MVP. Yes, and in fact, I'm very good friends with a lot of the IGN guys in the US. Yeah. I was there. I'm old enough to remember, a bit like Grandpa Simpson telling all these old stories. I remember when IGN was created, when it was Imagine Games Network. Mm. That's what the IGN originally stood for. Yeah, and I used to work for a company called Future Publishing, which they did in America. I was the editor of PC Gamer back many years ago. And Future became or launched an American version of itself called Imagine.
Yeah.
And Imagine Games Network was the online part of that. And many years later, it's obviously spun through different iterations. And IGN is now this big thing.
And Future.
But, yeah, I'm very friendly with a lot of, Greg Miller, who just left IGN, but he's a good friend of mine, Naomi Kyle.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Well, I tell you, I know that was not an easy decision for him because he loves IGN so much, but he wanted to, it's everyone's kind of doing their own thing these days.
Yeah, and it's not, we've all stayed friends and he'll continue to do bits and pieces
for Greg, who knows? I don't know if I reevaluate my friendship with Greg on a daily basis. You never know.
So I was going to kick off proceedings, Gary, by trying to give the listeners an insight into who you are. I want to know what your favourite game, film and TV show of all time are, if there's any chance you could pick one of each.
It's really hard to pick just one like that, isn't it? I mean, I do have like my top fives and things. Yeah. When I constantly reevaluate them. Interestingly, just this past week, I decided I my top five films, I move them around all the time.
Yeah. Mm.
There's a couple there that are just locks that never move, like The Empire Strikes Back will never, ever leave it.
Yeah.
That's always in there. And then there's always ones that are kind of on the bubble. There's been a bit of movement lately.
Okay.
I put Big Trouble in Little China in there last year.
Yeah.
And just this past year, it's funny, it's one of these films that doesn't get talked about enough, but whenever you mention it, people's eyes just light up because everyone recognizes what a great film it is. Master and Commander is one of my favorite films of all time.
Well, yeah. I was not expecting that.
No.
It's my greatest regret as a film fan that I never saw it on the big screen.
Right, okay.
Because it came and went without any noise, really, I didn't think to go and see it, and then I saw it years later on DVD, and it just absolutely blew me away. If you take any one thing from this podcast, go and see go see Master and Commander with Russell Crowe. It's an absolutely fantastic film, and I'm constantly looking to see if it's ever going to be brought back to the big screen, a revival or something, because I would totally go and see it.
And it was supposed to be a franchise, there's a bunch of books.
Patrick O'Brien wrote all these amazing books, and they did the first film, which I think combined a couple of the first two books together. And the idea was it was going to be a big franchise, but it didn't make enough money. We live in an age now where we have four Transformers films and only one Master and Commander, so something's not right.
So we got, is that three you've listed there?
So I did Empire, Big Trouble. Did Big Trouble and Master and Commander.
Yeah.
And then the other ones that moved, Die Hard's always in there.
Yeah.
And Raiders.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
You're a true man of the 80s.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
There's others that keep moving around. Back to the Future comes in and out. Midnight Run comes in and out. But, you know, I often, you know, myself and other screenwriter buddies often talk about, like, how close you can get to the idea of a perfect film.
Yeah.
And Raiders and Back to the Future and Empire are often, Jurassic Park, I think, is another one. It's very, very, unless you want to be, like, the ultimate nitpicker, and we are in a golden age of nitpickers these days with the internet. It's very, very hard to find any significant flaws with any of those films.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that's what we all aspire to, is to make something that good.
Well, the fact you mentioned Empire, it gives us a good excuse to talk about what your job has been for the last year. So what have you been working on?
I just got done working on what will be one of the new Star Wars films. I worked on it for pretty much an entire year. And as I'm sure you will appreciate, there's very little I'm allowed to say about any of it, because they take secrecy very, if you look at, you know, all the secrecy surrounding JJ's film, all of that applies to the one I worked on and to all of them.
See, that's why we should have got him drunk before starting the podcast.
Well, I quit drinking a few years ago. In anticipation of this, five years ago, I thought I might write a Star Wars film one day and then go on a podcast drunk. So I should probably stop drinking now so that can never happen. And look what happens. It worked out. So I worked on it. I will come back here in a couple of years, in December of 2016, when the film is out, and I'll happily tell you all of my stories of adventures in a galaxy far, far away.
But this is Gareth Edwards.
Gareth Edwards, who directed, who's another Brit. He's a boy from Nuneaton.
He is, yeah.
Who directed a terrific little independent film that he wrote and directed called Monsters, which if you've never seen it, see that. Really, really good. And then he made the Godzilla, which you saw last year. Mm. And he and I worked together for about the last year on the Star Wars, the first Star Wars standalone film, the one that will come out between episodes 7 and 8. And I already feel like I'm veering into, like, even though all this stuff is, I get very nervous whenever I talk about it, especially to a microphone. Yes, it was brilliant. By far the most rewarding and fun creative experience I've ever had. Like, the 12-year-old kid in me was just losing his shit, like, the whole time that I was doing it.
Yeah, and I, as a fan, I like the fact that a man who's, is one of his favourites, if not his favourite film of all time, is Empire Strikes Back, is writing a Star Wars film. That just sounds good to me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, it was one of those things where you're constantly pinching yourself, because, I mean, it's true of a whole generation of filmmakers that the original trilogy of those films, I think, inspired, literally, like I said, an entire generation of so many great filmmakers will tell you that Star Wars is the film that made them want to be a filmmaker. It's just this monumental edifice in popular culture. Mm. So to get to, you know, contribute a small piece to the legacy of that is just mad. And it was very nerve-wracking, but also just, like I said, I'll come back another day and I'll tell you, I will tell you stories and show you pictures. I've seen things you people wouldn't believe.
The last one on that subject, how does the film end that you've written then?
With the credits.
Very good. Very good. So have we got a game or a TV show that springs to mind?
TV show. It's hard, isn't it? Because, you know, you're always comparing, like, the stuff that's around, that's in your, like, Breaking Bad is the best show I've seen in the last 10 years. I know that. Mm. But in terms of, like, what meant a lot to me when I grew up, I mean, like, the original Star Trek was incredibly important to me. That's another one that I would put in the list of, like, if you make a list of what are the things that made you want to be a writer?
Yeah.
The original Star Trek. And it really, really bums me out that Star Trek is not, I think it's a crime anytime Star Trek's not on television. It should be constantly on television. Like, there should always be a version of Star Trek.
Yeah.
On TV, and it kind of bums me out a little bit that Star Trek has now become just a big blockbuster action movie franchise, because I don't ever think that's what it was meant to be. I think it was meant to be, like, about exploration and big science fiction ideas. You go back to the original Star Trek show, and it was written by, like, the great science fiction writers of the time.
Yeah.
And they had episodes that were about, like, really, you know, what science fiction is supposed to make you think about real stuff and have a message. The original Star Trek did that brilliantly. And I enjoy the new Star Trek films, but I think they've basically just become kind of more generic action blockbusters that happen to be set on the USS Enterprise.
Yeah.
It sounds like with this third one, they might be trying to get back more to the roots of Star Trek. I think the original idea was, like, grab them with big explosive action, build the audience, and then maybe kind of do some more Star Trek-y stuff. So,
well, that's what it sort of felt like at the end of the first one. They said, you know, they were going off to go on these new adventures, and then they
finally get to the 5-year mission at the end of the second film. So let's hope that they go and do some of those things.
Well, I'll do just a quick segue here, because this is an email that we've received, and I was going to save it till the end of the show, but It's from Harry Riatt, and he's talking about that. We talked about what TV shows we'd like to see come back.
Yeah.
Because of the X-Files potentially coming back. And he said, I would personally like to see a quality Star Trek show and was surprised it wasn't on your podcast list. It's been far too long since The Next Generation and Voyager. The storytelling on those shows was excellent and always kept me engaged. The last attempt, Enterprise, was a little weak, as I think there was little appeal in seeing the early days of the Enterprise with stripped back technology and a smaller crew. But imagine the likes of Bryan Cranston, Ian McKellen, Idris Elba, or Billy Bob Thornton in the roles of captains. A couple of more interesting choices would be the excellent Martin Freeman, who has blown me away with his performance in Fargo, and perhaps James Spader. A female captain would be good too, but I can't think of any right now.
Oh, come on.
And that's the end of his email. But
Not only do I find that somewhat sexist, yeah. it's actually a little bit speciesist as well. I've always had this weird theory that Star Trek is slightly racist in that it's racist towards all the other species. It takes all the non-human species and puts them in very stereotypical boxes. Like, okay, well, the Klingons, well, they're all just warlike. Mm. Well, the Ferengi, they're just greedy. The Vulcans, they're just very cold and logical, and they create these like very basic stereotypes.
That's a really good point.
None of the Star Trek races are like nuanced and layered in the ways that you think of. Like, yeah. There's no one like, okay, well, what are humans like? Well, there's no simple answer to that. They're all different kinds of humans. But there's only one kind of Klingon, which I think really, again, is a little bit racist. And we talk about, oh, let's have a black captain, we've done that. That's brilliant. Let's have a female captain, we've done that. When are they going to have a non-human captain?
That's a really good point.
In what's supposed to be kind of this incredibly inclusive Federation future where, you know, all the races are kind of pulling together and going towards this utopian Roddenberry type ideal, why is it so difficult for us to the idea of an alien captain?
And all the time, anytime you have like the Klingon on the ship, they're always trying to be more human as well. So, like, and if you have a Ferengi, they're always trying to be more human. They all need like a really, really small part
he's
of
like
this
an
human.
He's like an outlier.
Exactly. Yeah.
I had this idea of the. It kind of bugged me a little bit. I think it was a very brave decision, but it bugged me slightly that in the first new Star Trek film they destroyed Vulcan.
Yeah.
But spoiler, sorry. If you haven't seen it, it's your fault. You've seen it by now.
Long enough.
The statute of limitations has passed. Yeah. But I felt like that could have. I thought that would have led into a really interesting new TV show where, like, I would like to have seen like a Vulcan ship whose job it was to go and find a new homeworld.
Yeah.
And then in the second one, they just say, oh, how's things going on New Vulcan? Oh, well, I guess they found a new homeworld. But there could have been an interesting show there. But you would never get that through a Hollywood system because someone's going to say people won't watch non-human characters, which I think is nonsense.
You could have called it logical.
Star Trek logical.
Oh, yeah. I'd watch that.
I just feel bad that Harry can't think of a single female captain. Even though he thinks it's a good idea, he just can't think of a single one. What about Helen Mirren?
Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
Tilda Swinton.
Tilda Swinton would be amazing.
I've just done two right there.
Yeah. Have you seen her in Snowpiercer?
Literally took us 2 seconds. Yeah, she's mad, isn't it?
She's incredible.
She's like a space-age Hilda Ogden, which is like kind of crazy. I love it. I love her. She's one of those actresses where, like, I don't care what, I don't need to know anything else. Like, okay, so what's the movie? Well, Tilda Swinton. Okay, that's it. I'm good. You can stop there. Tilda Swinton. I'm
and I wonder what film she's been in that I've not recognised her because she's so unrecognisable in so many roles.
She's incredible.
Yeah.
She's great.
Let's get her as a captain, definitely. Well,
can you imagine her as a captain?
Well, Harry can't.
I would actually make her the female Vulcan captain of the show that I was just talking about.
Yeah,
Tilda really Swinton good. As the female Vulcan of a captain of a Vulcan ship or a Federation ship whose job it is to not seek out new worlds, but seek out a new world for the Vulcan people.
And she could be in it for a long time because she's not aging. I don't know if you've noticed.
No.
She's in her late 80s.
I think she's actually living a Vulcan lifespan, which is about 250 years.
Has anyone checked her ears?
She's doing very well for herself.
And finally, games. You started out in games, so what... I don't know, what's the seminal game of your lifetime, which is lifetime?
That's also, as well, like, you know, obviously you started out as a games journalist. I started out in future publishing as well. Like, how... has it changed? Like, how have you watched games journalism, like, change over the past few years since you started?
I mean, I've been out of games journalism now for nearly 15 years, so I've been very much kind of on the sidelines. Yeah. I started in 1988 on a magazine called Commodore User, reviewing Commodore 64 and Amiga games. Mm. And I was in the business up until the end of the millennium, like 2000, I think I left. I was the editor-in-chief of PC Gamer.
Yeah.
And so I worked through the 8-bit era... the 16-bit era, and then into what is now kind of the next, you know, the constant kind of recycling of next-gen technology and the PC, which has been the one constant. I don't know how much... I think journalism's actually become a lot better in the sense that if you look at the quality of reporting and think pieces and like really like back in the day when I was starting a magazine, game magazines were basically just catalogs.
Yeah.
Like here are the new games that are coming out. Here are some previews.
They
here
have good graphics. Reviews.
Yeah, excellent graphics. Excellent value for money. Two thumbs up. And that was but those were just guides to the and, but as the games have become more sophisticated and more challenging, especially with what's happening, you know, in the indie game scene where games are actually about things. Games have matured. Games journalism, I think, has been forced to mature along with it. And as the games have become more sophisticated, criticism has had to become more sophisticated. So, I mean, there are people that I enjoy reading tremendously. Like, again, back in the day, all you could read was, like, game reviews. And now you can read, like, really interesting pieces about the culture of games.
Yeah, definitely.
That I think are, you know, I think the whole thing is a lot more mature. And I'm actually kind of glad that I'm not in it anymore because I don't think I could play at that level. Like, it was actually much easier for me when I was just, like, putting together, you know, game reviews. And on PC Gamer, we tried to do some interesting features and stuff. I was around when Edge magazine first, I think, was one of the first magazines to really try and do something more mature and talk about games in a more grown up way. And now everyone's at it. And I think that's great. I think that gaming is still very much in kind of the silent movie era of its life cycle.
Okay, yeah.
We're still figuring out like how to tell interesting stories in video games. I think, you know, 20 years from now, we'll look back at what we have now and go, in the same way that you look back at like the Atari 2600 now, can you believe we ever played that?
Yeah.
You'll be looking back in 20 years at like Uncharted 4 and going, can you believe we ever thought that was impressive? And that's really exciting to think about that.
Yeah, no, definitely.
So it's been fascinating to see both the evolution, not just of the medium itself, but of the criticism around it, because both have, as one matures, the other is forced to mature with it. It's really interesting. Yeah. But favorite games, again, it's another one. It's like the ones that I grew up on when I was a kid. There's a Commodore 64 game called Paradroid, which is one of my all-time favorite games, and it's desperately, desperately in need of like a big 3D Unreal Engine remake.
That'd
could
be awesome,
totally do it. It'd be really cool. Of this like last generation, probably my favorite game. I mean, you know, the games that I've sunk the most time into, like the big AAA titles.
Yeah.
Mass Effect, the Red Dead games, you know, all the kind of, I'm not going to come out of left field with anything here.
Yeah, yeah.
Except to say that, and this is the only controversial thing I would say, my favorite game of the last 10 years was Journey.
Okay.
I think it was the, you know, I was very, very glad to see that it won every Game of the Year award that
year. It's fantastic.
And it's absolutely, like, it's as close, I think it's as close to genuine actual art as games have ever come.
Yeah.
I played that game, I didn't know what to expect going in, but a friend of mine just said, do this.
Yeah.
It only takes 2 hours to play. Unplug the phone, turn all the lights off, don't be interrupted, just play it for 2 hours solid, and don't like save and come back, just go all the
just
way through
it,
in 1 2-hour session. And I did, and at the end, I mean, we all played it to the end.
Yeah.
It was just so emotionally affecting, and I really looked like a game, it was a game that moved me in a way that I didn't think it was possible for that
definitely,
medium to do. I was just emotionally touched by it. Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, I think had a similar effect on me, and I think that's where we're going. We're going towards games that are not just increasingly fun to play, which used to be the only thing we cared about.
Yeah.
But now it's, again, we're judging games the same way that we judge more mature mediums like literature and films and television. Like, what does this say to us? How does it make us think about our lives and the world around us? How does it emotionally move us? We never used to care about that with video games. Now we do. And I think that's a really great sign of how this medium has matured.
Yeah.
We haven't matured at all, but the games have.
It was a suggestion of what the potential of games could be if you're not just going to go down this linear path of shoot 'em ups, football games. You know, it was
And again, there's still a place for that. There's still a place for like just turn your button off and shoot things and kick a ball around.
Mm.
No one's ever expecting the new FIFA game to emotionally move us.
Mm.
But the fact that there is now a whole new, it's interesting how it's talk about how things have changed. It's really interesting how it's been really cyclical. When I started, again, I wore an onion on my belt, which was the style at the time. I am very much a Grandpa Simpson in this conversation. Games were predominantly made by one person, literally in a bedroom. There's a really interesting documentary that came out last year called From Bedrooms to Billions.
I saw that,
It was about this whole, you know, this world, like people like Andrew Braybrook and Matthew Smith, who created the great games at the time. And it was literally one person who knew assembly language, who sat with their computer and made a game and put it on a cassette tape and sold it to whoever. And it was one guy created by this one person because games were small enough. They were created in like 16 or 48K that one person could create the entire thing. Now games are created by 250 person teams and have $100 million budgets. And so over time, it became less and less about the one really smart guy who could create something genius and put it out there with a vision. And it became more like Hollywood movies with these big mega productions. And those games are great. But I always kind of felt bad that the one man, the kind of auteur went away.
Yeah.
But now it's coming back.
Definitely,
Independent gaming has become a big deal. You've got people like Jonathan Blow and I guess not anymore, but for a while, Phil Fish and he was really smart. And look at Notch. Notch is the perfect example. Like, literally one guy in his bedroom who created something that became a global sensation. Have you seen the house he lives in now?
It's ridiculous.
So it has kind of come back around. And now I think it is a little bit similar to the Hollywood movie world, in that you've got these big, what we would think of as like AAA movies, like Star Wars and, you know, J.J. Abrams films and, you know, big blockbusters.
Yeah.
But there's also a really vibrant, interesting independent film scene, smaller budgets, smaller teams, where you can do things that are more daring and interesting because you don't have to worry about, finding a big audience.
Yeah.
And it's similar to now what we have. You have your Uncharted's and your Last of Us and your Mass Effect and your Red Dead's and those mega games, Destiny, what have you. But you've also got Spelunky and Braid and Journey and Limbo and these and really and, you know, Papers, Please, and these games that actually are, again, because they have smaller budgets and they don't have to worry about recouping massive development costs, they can try to do more interesting and daring things. And I think that a lot of AAA developers look at what the independent developers do, the risks they're taking, are inspired by that. And the independent scene, I think, is also helping move the big AAA development world towards more mature and more interesting stuff.
Definitely, yeah.
Cool. So we normally talk about what we've been up to. Have you done, seen, watched, been anywhere, Gav, of any interest? Because I haven't done much.
Other than the Super Bowl, no.
Okay, well, we're going to come to that.
Yeah.
Gary, you've been over in the UK for a month.
Yes.
So what have you done in that month?
Yeah, so the fact that I'm here, this is me being away. This is me on an adventure, even though I'm originally from England. I've lived in America for 20 years, so my accent's kind of gone all over the shop. But
it's kind of Australian.
Like, don't say that's the worst thing you can say to me. I apologise to any Australian, but I'm originally from the East End, and I used to sound like someone from Albert Square, and then I moved to America, and I picked up this weird accent. Anyway, so I've lived there for 20 years, and this is actually the longest I've ever been back. I've been here for a whole month. I came here literally to kind of finish off on Star Wars, because the whole production's moved to Pinewood now.
They're
kind of ramping up to shoot that film. And then the rest of my time here has really just basically been holiday, because I've worked so... Like, I had my head down on Star Wars for the best part of a year for so long that just completely to the exclusion of everything else. And my wife will tell you what a misery I've been to live with for the past year. So it was actually nice to have a bit of a holiday and to come back to where I'm from. Like I said, I was born and raised in London, to be here. And fortunate also to do some fun stuff. So I got to go to the premiere of Kingsman.
Yeah,
Secret Service.
We were both at Kingsman Secret Service. We both enjoyed it, it's fair to say.
I enjoyed it tremendously. I'm obviously biased. Because
I was
going
to say, you had a better reason to be at the premiere than me. So what was your reason?
It was actually really interesting. So I'm doing... So the next project that I'm doing, I'm literally starting it next week when I go back to San Francisco, is Mark Miller's next film. So Mark, obviously, as people know, did Kick-Ass and Wanted, and now... Kingsman of the Secret Service, and he has this incredible track record of creating comic books which become movies. I don't think he has a single comic book that isn't actually like set up to be a movie somewhere. It's incredible.
Basing Avengers Civil War on his Avengers.
That's right. So Civil War. Mark, so apparently he came up with the helicarrier and all kinds of stuff that is now
in
the Avengers world.
And Fantastic Four is largely based on his Ultimates.
His version of Fantastic Four. So Mark's obviously a titanic figure in comics. Through his contribution to the Marvel Universe and now his original stuff. So he has a book that has been out, and I think the graphic novel, like the trade version, is just coming out now, called Starlight. And Starlight is basically what would happen if Flash Gordon got old. So, you know, this character, this astronaut goes into space and gets sucked through a black hole, has this amazing adventure, Flash Gordon adventure, saves the galaxy. But when he comes back to Earth, no one believes that he did any of that. He's got no proof. And he becomes kind of a bit of a laughing stock, and he gets old and becomes kind of bitter about the fact that no one ever appreciated what he did. And then, of course, you know, the spaceship lands in the back garden, and an alien gets out and says, "We need you to come back because our planet's been taken over again, and you were the guy that saved us before."
But he's old now.
But now he's like 30 years older and 30 pounds heavier, and like, you know, the suit doesn't fit anymore. He has to take pills for his back. So it's kind of fun. You know, what I love about Mark is that all of his stories are great popcorn entertainment on the surface, but underneath they all have something to say. Like, definitely, Kingsman is like can you take a chav and turn him into James Bond is a hilarious idea, and you can see the potential of the film. And my one takeaway from it, which I loved, is that it's very much like the kind of James Bond film that you wish they'd still made, but they don't. I mean, the new ones are great, but we all like kind of the camp craziness of the old Connery and Roger Moore films, and that's basically what they recaptured. So on the surface, that's what it is, and it's a lot of fun. But what it's really about, I think, is the class struggle in England and the idea of social mobility. There's a great moment in it where Taron Egerton, the kid who plays like the kid from the council estate, says to Colin Firth, "I'm just as if I'd have been born with the same silver spoon that you had, I would have been just as good as you, if not better. But I, you know, society never gave me that opportunity.
Yeah.
So, you know, especially in England, where there is that idea of you know, these different kind of class tiers, I think I felt like the film had something to say. So it worked out very brilliantly for me in that I was here in London, just kind of like bobbing about, looking for things to do. I was on holiday and Mark said, do you want to come to the premiere of Kingsman? It's next week. Brilliant. I'm like, my hotel's just down the road from Leicester Square. So we went and I got to meet Mark and hang out with him and saw the film. I said, the film's tremendous fun.
Yeah.
And then literally the next day kind of sat together with Mark's Starlight Comics, like two kids having a comic swap.
Yeah.
And kind of talked about what we think the movie's going to be. So that's really exciting.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. Mm. And by the time this goes out, we'll have a video on the site with me and Mark discussing who should play Duke McQueen.
Duke McQueen is the lead character, and he's like a cross between Neil Armstrong and Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah.
And Flash Gordon, I suppose, because it is very much Mark's tribute to Flash Gordon. Who does Mark want to play, or do you want to give that away?
No, he talks about it in the interview, which is on there. He's saying how difficult this is because whoever gets cast, once they could go back and look at this interview and go, oh, we talked about these six actors and none of them were me.
Yeah.
But he, him and his artist originally talked about him being a little bit like Liam Neeson.
Okay.
Although I think Liam Neeson's a bit young because this guy's supposed to be slightly past it, whereas Liam Neeson doesn't feel like he's past it at all at the moment. Yeah.
It's very interesting because, you know, when I went into 20th Century Fox and pitched for the job, I said to them, you know, if you're going to do this right, you need to embrace the idea that this is an older guy. The whole point of the story is about getting older and also kind of recapturing your youth. But that only works if you cast someone who is legitimately at that age. Like, that's very hard to fake. You can't just, like, put a grey wig on someone.
Yeah.
Or put some old age makeup on them. People are going to know if it's like Bradley Cooper in prosthetic makeup.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
And so you want someone that kind of legitimately kind of feels their age.
It doesn't really feel that with Neeson,
though. It's so much of a relief to go from a project where for a year I was literally, and still am literally allowed to say pretty much nothing, to this where you can actually go buy the comic of Starlight right now and read the whole story. I can't really spoil too much because
it's all in there.
It's based on the comic. And as you know, Mark is very big on just, you know, go out and promote it. So it's a bit very refreshing change of pace for me. And like I said, I hope that they will find someone for the role that is appropriate for it and it isn't like some kind of
We've mocked up some posters as well, which will be on the site. That we talked about. Yeah, Kirk Douglas, we mocked up one with him.
Oh, so that kind of age, yeah.
Well, not quite that old.
I only brought that one up with Mark because when I was reading it, I was seeing a younger Kirk Douglas.
Okay, yeah.
But not now, but Michael Douglas
talked
about.
Yeah, Clint Eastwood was 20 years younger.
Yeah, that's
perfect.
It. Yeah.
Because you want some, the idea is that that this character, like Flash Gordon, like Neil Armstrong, whatever, is kind of an American icon. So the idea of like finding an actor who also is that in themselves would be great.
Because he said Schwarzenegger's come up in conversations, but he feels like it should be someone more all-American. Although you can't get more all-American than Schwarzenegger, but he's not American. So.
Yes, he's the most American non-American.
He's the epitome of the American dream. He just happens to be from a foreign country.
I think
everyone who is the epitome of the American dream is from a foreign country, because that was the whole point.
Yeah. Godfather. That's a bad example. But you're also...
Yeah, Scarface.
Yeah.
There you go. That's the American dream. That's the perfect American dream.
But you're also talking about your first ever novel as well. Abomination.
Yeah, so as I said to you before, I would happily just be here just to podcast and have fun because I like to podcast. And I do the tested.com podcast a lot in the United States. And again, didn't get to do it much of anything for the past year because I've been so busy working on other things. So I would happily just come here just to have fun.
Yeah.
But it does, I do have also have something to plug. So thank you very much.
The timing is good. So what is it?
I'm going to keep it really, really short because this is the plug part. I don't want to bore anyone, but I wanted to try and do something. So, I've obviously written a bunch of movies, wrote The Book of Eli, co-wrote, can't stress that enough, After Earth. And
I literally cannot stress that enough.
And now... and now worked on Star Wars and I'm doing Starlight. So my day job is as a screenwriter, but I wanted to try and do something different. And I tried writing I wanted to do a kind of a fantasy thing. And I didn't know if it would be a commercial thing as a movie. Original films are really, really hard to get made in this business. Everything has to be a franchise. Everything has to be an adaptation. There are still people to this day that come up to me and ask me what the Book of Eli was based on. And when I tell them it was just an original idea.
I think I vaguely did that to you on Friday.
They don't quite understand. Well, I remember at Comic-Con when we announced it,
I'm still not sure you're telling the truth. That no, it wasn't based on a comic.
Go check it. When we showed the first trailer at Comic-Con, I remember it was like one of the big Hall H things where it was part of a Warner Brothers presentation of like seven different films. And it was sort of like Sherlock Holmes, the Robert Downey Sherlock Holmes was a big thing that year. A bunch of like, I think the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, one of the Spider-Man films maybe. No, not Spider-Man, but one of the, some comic book thing.
Yeah.
And Eli, and of the seven films that they showed, Eli was the only one that wasn't based on something else. It was an original film. And so this is the culture that we've created now. We literally had like a kid come up and on the microphone, you know, when they're asking the panel questions, what were the challenges in adapting the comic book into the Book of Eli? And the director had to say, there was no comic book, this is an original script. And you can see people in the audience going, what? It's original script. So that, I mean, that's the culture we've created. Everything is obviously, you know, we live in a world of like Marvel and Star Wars and Star Trek and Harry Potter and Twilight and 50 Shades of Grey, and everything's a big pre-existing property. I mean, like outside of like Chris Nolan and a handful of other people, it's very, very hard to like find like great original movies, especially at that kind of AAA level that are being made. It just doesn't happen in Hollywood anymore, and that's a little bit depressing. And so rather than try and write this idea as a film, which you know, it's always an uphill struggle trying to get an original film made, especially the way I typically write films, they tend to be, they're going to cost a lot of money, big special effects and stuff like that. So I thought, well, I'll just write this one as a book. It's really, really, it's the thing that I discovered, and it's kind of revelatory to me. When you write a screenplay for a film, you're not writing the finished product that the audience will see. You're writing the blueprint for what you hope hundreds of other people will spend millions and millions of dollars turning into the final finished product that the audience will ultimately see. And I've had mixed results with that. The Book of Eli, you know, whether you like it or not, that's the film that I wrote, and they pretty much shot the script that I wrote, and I look at it and I'm very proud of it. So, wow, that was like, that's, I remember thinking at the beginning, that's the one that I get.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. I played my Joker really early. They actually shot the film that I wrote, because as a writer, you don't really have any control or equity. Once you sign the script over, they own it. They can do whatever. They can fire you. They can replace you. They can rewrite you. They can do whatever they want. And the film that comes out at the other end, it's really kind of a crapshoot. Is it going to be what I originally intended?
Yeah.
And with Eli, it was. With After Earth, not so much. Okay. Well, that wasn't my original idea, but the film is, it went, changed a lot from the draft of the screenplay that I wrote. And, you know, with Star Wars, we'll see. And with everything else that I do, every screenwriter will tell you the same story. And it can often be frustrating. And it's particularly frustrating when it's something that you create yourself, because that feels like your baby. But then you kind of have to give your baby up to someone else and let them raise it and turn it into the finished thing, and you don't know what's going to come back at the end. So
that's hard, especially with something like Star Wars, where you think you spend a year of your life on it, and then you have no idea what's coming back.
Well, but you're also very aware of the fact that that is someone else's property that you're just very privileged to even be allowed, you know, to work on.
And I imagine they're paying you well for it, that privilege as well.
But like I said, it's tougher when you create something of your own, and I generally prefer not, again, with something like Star Wars, obviously you're going to make an exception, but I prefer not to work on other people's stuff and try to create my own original things. Like Mark Miller has been very successful. I think Mark, even though he was like tremendously successful Marvel writer, decided that he just didn't want to work on other people's characters anymore and wanted to create his own characters that he owned, and went off and was very successful at that. So I try to do that. I try to create my own stuff, and got very lucky once. Don't necessarily know if I will be again. So for this next idea that I had, I thought, well, rather than write it as a movie, I'm going to try writing it as a novel, because that is the finished product, right? The book that you write, obviously it goes through an editorial process, but you are ultimately the author of that product.
Yeah.
That thing,
no matter
what, the audience will see, much more so than in a film where really the director is really the author of the film. And again, if they use your script, great, who knows. I often tell people, and people laugh when they hear the story because it seems preposterous, but this is the daily reality of Hollywood. If Stephen King wrote a novel and his publisher came back and said, well, Stephen, we love the new novel, but we're not thrilled about the third act, so we're going to sack you and bring in John Grisham to rewrite the third act, and maybe your name will end up on the book, maybe it won't, who knows. We'll see. That you laugh because it's preposterous,
that's
right?
And yet
that's the daily reality of working as a writer in Hollywood. Mm. And so the idea of running it as a book, I just thought it was a way to kind of tell a story that would not go through that filter, through that process. And at the end of this, when the book comes out, if people like it, I can take all of the credit, and if people hate it, I will take all of the blame. But it's the product of one person as opposed to hundreds of person. When you, and don't get me wrong, I love working in Hollywood, and it's incredible. I like to collaborate, and it's incredible amount of fun. But I wanted to try something different.
Yeah.
So I wrote this book called Abomination. It's kind of a fun mix of historical fiction and fantasy, in that it's set in England during the Dark Ages, during the reign of King Alfred the Great, but it's kind of an alternate version of history where monsters and magic exist. Yeah. So it's a little bit kind of Game of Thrones, a little bit Viking invasion, and kind of I took history and fantasy and kind of mashed it all up. And it's really, really fun, I think. And
you hope.
We'll see. I mean, the people that have read it so far seem to really like it.
Oh, that's cool.
So on Monday, this is going out on Friday, right?
Yeah.
On the Monday, you'll be able to go to a website called inkshares.com and pre-order it.
Oh,
and I hope people will do that. We're doing it in kind of an interesting way, in that it's going to be kind of crowdfunded in a sense. Okay. Inkshares is a company that I'm a big fan of crowdfunding and kind of the democratization of content, in that it's no longer about a handful of gatekeepers that can say, well, this is what the audience is, this is what the market is going to be given to choose from.
Yeah.
If you look at YouTube, obviously, is like the market's decided who rises to the top and who's successful and what shows take off and so forth. Kickstarter is obviously, if it weren't for Kickstarter, we wouldn't have the Oculus Rift. We wouldn't have all kinds of cool stuff that exists today. And Inkshares is kind of like Kickstarter for books, in that we'll put it up there and you can pre-order the book, and there's a certain number that they have to hit. And if enough people pre-order the book, it will go into full production and everyone will get their copy.
Yeah.
But if you go to Inkshares on Monday, you will get a signed limited edition hardcover and an ebook that comes with it for free. And it's all very cool. And that's my plug.
Wow. That was a proper plug, wasn't it?
That was a
proper
plug. Yeah.
That's as good, that. And now normal service can be resumed.
Excellent.
So, did you watch the Super Bowl?
I watched, oh my God, I'm so, you know what? I've had the worst luck in my life with sporting events, where like, it's always the one where I'm like, I won't bother.
Yeah, it's like, a good one.
It was like, oh my God, did you see? I ended up missing the best one. Yeah. Like, it was a few years ago, it was like the best Wimbledon final ever, and it was the only one that I missed.
Yeah.
So because I'm here in the UK, of course, the time's all off. Mm. Typically on Super Bowl Sunday in the UK, sorry, in the US, where I live, especially on the West Coast, it's on in the middle of the afternoon, and you can sit and watch it, and that's your Sunday afternoon. Here, it didn't start until midnight.
Yeah.
So, I didn't really have a dog in the fight. I'm a San Francisco 49ers fan, so I never really have to worry about the Super Bowl all that much. But I've got a lot of friends who are Seahawks fans, because there's a lot of people that work at Microsoft and Bungie and places like that up there are big Seahawks fans. And I've got a lot of friends on the East Coast as well. Somebody said it's like PAX Prime versus PAX East. It kind of is a little bit like that. So I was like, I was just kind of like, may the best team win.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit of an edge for the Seahawks, because I feel like they're just a fun team.
Yeah.
And I watched the first half, and it was tied, right? 14-14. I was like, okay, well, that's good. And then Katy Perry came on the line. I was like, I just don't need it. But then it turns out that I didn't see, I have to watch it on YouTube. Apparently, it was really, the halftime show was really fun and really,
really good.
People like the Dancing Sharks and all of that stuff.
Missy Elliott came out and did like a 10-minute just Missy Elliott.
Everyone was blown away by Missy Elliott. And the other thing that bums me out in the UK is that you don't get any of the commercials.
Yeah, that's really
annoying. Reason to watch the game.
That's why you go to IGN, because we put the commercials up as they're being broadcast.
See, now you're doing a nice little play. So I went back and I watched the highlights. Like, of course, I wake up in the morning, I turn on my phone, and it's like a million times going, oh my God, can you believe what's happening? I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have gone to sleep.
Yeah.
And I watched the highlights, and of course, it was very interesting. The game itself was fun to watch. We've been really, really lucky with the Super Bowl, in that almost all of them in the last 10 or 15 years have actually been really, really great games.
Yeah.
Either because they're really close or spectacular blowouts that are also fun to watch.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen any of the commercials yet, because I've got to find time to kind of dial them up on YouTube and watch them separately.
Exactly.
But it sounded like it was a good, like the game was good. The commercials were kind of a weird mixed bag, and that some of them were like real downers this year.
Well, they released a lot of them before as well, which really
Nationwide was the one that really threw.
Did you see it?
I've not watched it.
I'm kind of scared because I've got a daughter. I'm kind of scared to watch it.
Well, I thought the Breaking Bad one, the one with Bryan Cranston, I thought that was disgusting. Like, I don't know. Like, maybe Americans give over that. I just thought it was really dirty.
It always kind of bothers me when things that... I mean, look, we live in a commercial world. Yeah. I get it. And everyone needs to earn a living.
Of course,
but
yeah.
Like, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a I can't remember what chocolate bar it is.
Right.
Where they took Audrey Hepburn and they kind of photoshopped her,
yeah,
like a chocolate bar into her hand. It's awful, from, like, yeah, from, I think it was from La Dolce Vita or one of the old films. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, these people are going to be spinning in their graves. Like, it's really disrespectful. Yeah. And if Bryan Cranston and the people that own the rights to Walter White want to do that, more power to them. But I understand why it does leave a sour taste in some people's mouths.
Well, have you seen those,
the Liam Neeson Clash of Clans one was apparently quite entertaining.
No, I didn't see that one. Have you seen those adverts in maybe they're only in the UK with Winston Wolfe from Pulp Fiction?
Yes!
Oh my God.
So they're only here
disgusting.
In the UK, right?
Yeah.
It's actually really interesting to come to the UK and see, like, Kevin Bacon doing ads for cell phones.
Oh my God, yeah. Ask Kevin Bacon as well.
And Harvey
yeah.
Keitel doing Winston. Presumably Tarantino's getting some money from that, right? Because he's not just...
You'd
he's playing
so.
The character.
Yeah.
He's playing the wolf.
Mm.
And so... And what's weird is you never see those commercials in the same way that, you know, they do those deals where, like, they'll go...
To Japan.
To Japan and sell a fizzy drink.
Yeah. Schwarzenegger in Japan.
But there's a very specific rule that those can't be shown in the US.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I came to the UK a couple of years ago that I realised that over here, George Clooney is as well known for Nespresso as he is anything else.
Yeah.
In the US, no one knows that. It's really interesting.
Well, Lost in Translation was about that, wasn't it?
Exactly.
It was all about that. So, it's weird to see Kevin Bacon and Harvey Keitel. And all these.
I can sort of understand Kevin Bacon, but Harvey Keitel, you think, come on, mate.
Harvey Keitel needs to feed his kids as much as the next guy.
I guess so, yeah.
So, did you watch the trailers?
I did, yeah.
And what was your favourite of the Super Bowl movie trailers?
It was always going to be Jurassic World. That's always going to be like.
Now, the first trailer for that landed with a bit of a thud, didn't it? But this one has turned some more people around.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said. There's a lot in the trailers that have been shown that people can easily not like, I think, because there's a lot of odd things being done and a lot of different things being done from the films. But I don't know. I'm on board. I love Jurassic Park. I love Chris Pratt and I love Colin Trevorrow. And I think it's going to be a really good one.
And there is basically goodwill for it, right? And when a lot of times when people bring back, like, older film series, like whether it be Terminator or whatever, there's sometimes some cynicism about that. But people generally, like, are on board with the idea of a new Jurassic Park film.
I found it a bit underwhelming. I think part of the trouble was the CGI wasn't finished in a lot of scenes for that first trailer. And we did a comparison. We did a video on it yesterday. And it's amazing how different it is. You know, lots more dinosaurs, better looking dinosaurs. Entire backgrounds change. Yeah. And it's just, it gives you an insight into that
the
process.
The same is true with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. You could see the evolution of the CG through the trailer. They've got to show something.
Sure.
But it's, again, what you saw on Super Bowl Sunday, by the time it gets to the theatre, it'll be even better than that.
I miss the days of, and they still do it every now and then, but the full-on teaser, though. The first one being a teaser where it's no footage from the film, but they've created something totally.
Yeah.
I mean, the original Jurassic Park
one,
it was, you know, them finding their
footprint, wasn't it?
I remember.
Like, you have the water,
I remember.
And thing,
this is what I mean. The age of the internet is, for the most part, brilliant.
Yeah.
But there are some things that we lost. I remember, as I think it was 90, whatever it was. It was a long time ago. I remember going, well, I'll tell you what it was. I went to see Highlander 2, which for the most part I try to forget about. But what I remember was, so this is pre-internet.
Yeah.
You don't usually know, like, this is before. And now when you go to see a movie and the trailer comes up, the second it pops, I'm like, I know what this is.
Yeah.
Because I've heard about it, read about it. I've probably seen the clips online.
Yeah.
It's like all information all the time. And there's no surprises anymore. Often by the time you go see a film, it just films like an assembly of all the clips that you've seen, but with some filler in there.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's so rare to go see a film completely dry, you know, completely clean. And I remember going to see Highlander and this trailer came up and it was like this weird factory and they were assembling like these robot parts. And I'm going, what is this? And then you hear boom, 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 boom. I was like, they're making a new Terminator. I had no idea they're making a new Terminator film. And you see the robot. You can go. It's one of the most famous teasers of all time. Remember, this is a robot factory.
Yeah.
And then the guy steps out, and it's Schwarzenegger. And I remember just losing my. I was like, oh my God, because I had no idea.
Yeah.
But now, of course, like look at the new Terminator film. Now, like, it's all been dribbed and drabbed out as we go, and people just aren't super excited as much as because, like, we heard when it was announced, we heard all the casting. You hear every little thing from every fan site, and by the time the trailer comes out, it almost feels like anticlimactic.
I
miss those days. Film Crit Hulk, who's a guy that I like to follow on Twitter, who writes a lot of very intelligent stuff about film, mentioned that he stopped watching trailers a couple of years ago. He just won't watch them.
Yeah.
Because you can make the choice not to watch them.
Definitely.
Go into the theater after the trailers have shown. Just don't click play on the button. So I'm probably not doing you any favours here.
Yeah.
Where you need your clicks.
Yeah. We did a 20-minute video about the 2-minute Fantastic Four trailer.
That's funny. But he mentioned that his life as a film goer and his appreciation and enjoyment of films got a lot better.
Yeah.
Just going in and not knowing anything about it.
Yeah, I sometimes shut my eyes.
Do you really?
Yeah. So I can hear what's being said, but I can't see the visuals, and that doesn't spoil it as much for me.
Yeah.
But I look weird. If you look around, you see me, I'm just like...
Yeah.
But you can't help yourself, though. Like, when the Force Awakens trailer came out...
Exactly, yeah.
Like, I was like, what? I'm just not going to click on it. I'd much rather just go in and see it cold as much as the next guy. And 5 seconds later, I was watching. Yeah. Can't help you. I had no discipline at all.
Well, my favourite of the Super Bowl teasers was the one that felt the most like a teaser. It was Tomorrowland, which is the new Brad Bird film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's shrouded in mystery, a bit
they've done a good job with
it. Like Super 8. I think Super 8 was the last film that really tried to do that, where you really didn't know until you went in to see that movie what it was about.
Good, yeah.
And, you know, they just put clues there, and it's a really nice little teaser. And I just like that mystery. I like having that mystery. There's a whole new world there. And, you know, you talked about earlier the fact that it was, you know, if you look down the list, I think 90% of these are sequels, you know, remakes. Tomorrowland's the one that's...
Is there, in fact, an original... Apart from Tomorrowland, is there an original film on that list?
Well...
That's not...
You got a comedy called Unfinished Business,
okay.
But that's kind of separate.
Okay, but look, 50 Shades of Grey, no. Ted 2, no. Pitch Perfect 2, no. Fury 7, no. Jurassic World, no. Seventh Son, no. Avengers 2, no. Divergent, no. Hot Tub Time Machine 2, no. Kingsman, no. Minions, no. Terminator, no. So two out of what, a dozen?
Yeah.
Remember what I was just saying? This is the world we live in.
Yeah. And but
Furious 7.
But for me, that was why it was the most exciting one, though, because, you know, I was just seeing a bit more Avengers. I'd seen footage before. We've seen the first film. I just like seeing new stuff, and we just don't see nearly enough of it.
Yeah,
gets me down.
It's hard.
So the one that I probably saw the most traffic on, like the people that got the most chatter, was Furious 7, because they're driving cars between skyscrapers now. Yeah.
Which surprised me, because that was in the first trailer, that scene of the car going between the two buildings. But I
want to know what scene there. I'm like, I have to see the film because I just want to know the context for that. Like, how do they set that up?
Exactly.
How in the story do they get? Because this is often what happens in Hollywood. They will say, okay, we want a scene where Vin Diesel drives a car out of the window of one skyscraper and crashes into another one. Now figure out how to get us there in the script. And I went to
a Q&A with Jackie Chan before Christmas, and that was exactly what he was talking about. He said, I come up with the stunts,
the set pieces.
And then I tell them, and then they've got to write a story around it.
Yeah.
Maybe that is...
A lot of Hollywood filmmaking is done that way. Mission Impossible 2 was made that way, where John Woo had like a half dozen set pieces that he knew he wanted.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the job of the writer... is to just kind of like thread them all together narratively.
And with Bond, it's as much about the locations.
Right.
We've got these five locations for this one. Let's write the story around them and the action set pieces.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a really famous Kevin Smith story where he talks about writing his Superman draft, and he said, no matter what, in the third act, there has to be a giant spider.
But yeah, so those were the teasers. Any other news? I gave you a little bit of news, Gav, that was
kind of
a bit off the wall. But I'd like to get Gary's feedback on it.
Okay. What is it?
I'll read it in my best news voice.
Is this going to? Is this something I don't know about?
It's just a wacky news story this week.
Go on then.
School suspends boy for threatening another boy with the One Ring. A Texas boy has been suspended from school for threatening to make his classmate disappear via the One Ring from the fictional world of The Lord of the Rings. Aiden Stewart, a 9-year-old from Kerman Elementary School, was suspended for threatening another child with purported magic powers. According to Aiden's father, Jason, the Stewart family had just seen The Hobbit Battle of Five Armies the previous weekend, inspiring Aiden to bring a ring to school and tell a classmate that he was going to make him disappear by putting it on. I assure you, my son lacks the magical powers necessary to threaten his friend's existence. Jason Stewart wrote in an email to the New York Daily News. If he did, I'm sure he'd bring him right back.
Where did this happen? Because I want to say Florida.
Elementary.
Where was it?
Kermit Elementary.
Kermit?
Yeah.
Where's Kermit Elementary?
And where is this in the UK or in the US?
No, this is in the States.
If you're going to a school
named after a Muppet, I think you're in trouble. You're in trouble from the start.
You said it before me. That's just a wonderful little story, though, isn't it?
It's nice. Did you see the one the other day about the kid who got a bill for not showing up at another kid's birthday party?
It's awful.
What has happened to the world?
I know, it's terrible. But
there was more to that story than met the eye, I heard, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like, what?
I think there'd been some agreement about payment or something. Oh, I don't know.
Oh, right, that. Okay, not the...
No, that one. No, that one. He really did have the one ring. That's what they've not mentioned there.
Yeah, yeah, he actually could have done it, so it actually was a real terrorist threat.
The kid is called Harry Potter.
He actually was carrying a weapon of mass destruction in his pocket.
The other bit of news this week is Better Call Saul is finally coming to Netflix. So we've got our review up already. We gave it 8.7 out of 10.
Oh, really?
Weirdly, it's coming to Netflix in the States... The first two episodes on Sunday night.
Yeah.
And it's coming to the UK. The first episode, Monday morning, 7 a.m. The second episode, Tuesday morning, 7 a.m.
What are they doing?
Which makes it a kind of... It doesn't give you an easy point of entry, does it?
Didn't they do Breaking Bad the same way, though, where it would show on... It would show in on American television on Sunday night and it would be on UK Netflix the following morning.
It was just the final series, and it's why so many people I know actually signed up to Netflix. It's a brilliant...
Oh, it was a huge driver.
Amazing,
Because what happened was, it's interesting, if you look, if you chart the... audience of Breaking Bad, you know, it starts very small, and then because it's such a good show, word starts to get out. Oh, you got to watch Breaking Bad, it's on Netflix, and you see it go up and up and up to the point where by the time everyone had caught up on Netflix, and the ratings for the final season were just astronomical.
Well, so, it's not on BBC Two over here, and then it's sort of...
It was one of those ones they
away,
shifted
yeah.
it around, though. It'd be 11 p.m. on a Sunday.
Exactly,
and, then,
and they showed three episodes or something like that. Yeah,
no, it was hard to grab a hold of. Yeah. But how do you feel about Better Call Saul? Because I know when they first announced it, I thought, I don't need this in my life.
Yeah, I don't. I don't
I think
at all.
I was saying to you the other day, I've got... Sometimes with prequels, just generally, I have a bit of a problem with them.
I was a little bit cynical when I first heard about it, because I think often the model in television is that once you make a hit, don't let it go.
Yeah.
It's why you often see the last film in a big franchise getting split into two, because they just don't want to say goodbye.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, did The Hobbit really need to be three films? Probably not. Did the last, maybe the last Harry Potter one did, I don't know, but like, you know, the last Twilight, the last, there's a reason why like the last Twilight film, the last Harry Potter film, the
Hunger
Games, they're all going to be two films, is because they know the gravy train is coming to an end and they want to just like extend it out for as, you know, why make a ton of money on one film when you can make twice as much money on two? So it's a very commercial decision. Yeah. And, you know, I think creatively I think all of these shows actually be good, but you know, there's a reason why there's going to be a Walking Dead spin-off show.
Yeah.
There's a reason why there's now a Breaking Bad spin-off show. AMC has had, which is the network that makes these shows in the United States, has had tremendous success with The Walking Dead and Breaking Bad and Mad Men. Mm. But the second generation of shows that they've tried has been very hit and miss. So you can understand a little bit why they've gone back to the well and like, while we try and find the next Breaking Bad, would you just make the next Breaking Bad for us, please?
Yeah.
So I was a little bit cynical when I first heard it, because I'm looking at it from I see what they've done there. They just don't want to let this go. But as we get closer to learning more about the show, and it actually does look like it's genuinely very good.
Yeah.
And I don't think Vince Gilligan, who's a guy I admire tremendously, would have done it for any money if he didn't think there was a valid, if there was a real show to be made there.
I think that's right. Yeah.
So I trust him. If Vince Gilligan tells me this is a legitimate thing that Breaking Bad fans are going to love, and and that there's a creative reason for this to exist, I trust and believe it. I will watch it, and I have a strong suspicion it's going to be really good.
Mm. Yeah. And it sounds like he goes on a similar journey almost, because at the start of this one, Saul Goodman is not the Saul that we meet in Breaking Bad.
Right, okay.
He's not quite, he's not dealing with as bad a people, he's not dealing with the darkness.
Right.
And so it's kind of watching his journey in the same way to Walter White, who starts out a very different man to the one he ends up as.
That's interesting, then, because I've sort of avoided everything about it for the same reason. I just thought I couldn't be arsed with it.
And he's a great character. I mean, in the original Breaking Bad, you're always happy when Bob Odenkirk's on the screen.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely.
He's a tremendous character.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not, you know, you can imagine this just like as the show is, here's this colourful, very shady. But actually, the thing I loved about Saul Goodman is that, he comes in wearing the cheap, badly coordinated suit and looks like the only lawyer that you can afford. But the reality is he was actually really shrewd and a really sharp lawyer.
Yeah.
And, you know, very, very good at what he did.
Definitely.
And so the idea of that character, and he's got all these kind of shady, wacky clients, like you can see that as like a Fox show.
Yeah.
But the version of this where you're taking a character that we already know and love, and, you know, I think they've probably done a very good, you know, everyone's into universe building these days, you know, whether it be Marvel or whoever, that, you know, they've obviously got 5 years of Breaking Bad that they can refer to, and, you know, Mike's obviously back as well.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah,
and I suspect that down the line, you know, Bryan Cranston and Aaron will show up as well. Mm. And I'm excited for it. I think it's going to be, and again, it's purely because I always look at, well, who's doing it?
Yeah.
If Vince Gilligan had said no and they'd bust in some other crew to do it, I'd be very, very cynical about it.
Yeah.
But given that it is Vince who, you know, and again, Breaking Bad is probably the best television program of this generation. Mm. Did you watch the finale of it? I was like, I can't remember when I was so on the edge of my seat, and I was so sad to see it go because it was such a great show, but also kind of relieved because I got to a point where I almost didn't look forward to watching it every week because that last season was so stressful. Yeah. It was a masterpiece of television.
Which is an event as well. Breaking Bad was such a huge event. Like, I watched it with the guys I work with. We all got together in the big meeting room on a big screen and watched it all together and then sat around for just hours.
It was actually quite emotional because you remember it's a tremendous amount of, especially the last season being as good as it was, just a tremendous amount of expectation and pressure for what that, like, how do you wrap that up? And we've seen so many finales of shows that couldn't possibly live up to the hype. Mm. And at the end of it, I need to go back and watch it another time. But I just watched it the one time when it was on live. And I remember sitting there thinking, they did it. That's the right end to the show. They pulled it off. And it's incredibly difficult to do that.
Yeah, I just heard an interview recently with Larry David saying why he won't do a finale to Curb Your Enthusiasm. Because he said people were so pissed off with Seinfeld.
They had a bad experience with Seinfeld.
He said to this day, I think we did all right. I think we wrapped it up in the way it should have wrapped up. But so many people are annoyed with me that, sod it, I'm just not going to bother. You know, I won't do it again.
Yeah, just say that was the last episode. Yeah. But not everything has to be some event where everyone says goodbye. In a serialized show like Breaking Bad, obviously the story has to come to a conclusion. But in like an episodic, it's really, really weird. One of my guilty pleasures used to be CSI Miami.
Okay.
And, you know, which is not a serialized show. It's Case of the Week.
Yeah.
And they went, it's interesting, when they went into what proved to be their final season, they didn't know if they were going to get picked up for another season or not. So they didn't know if they were making the series finale, the season finale, or the series finale.
That's good, isn't it?
And so they kind of wrapped up just away with like all the people from the CSI lab.
Yeah.
I can't believe we're talking about CSI Miami. but it is a good guilty pleasure show. We're just sitting around just like having a drink and everyone's happy.
Yeah.
And so they could go and make another season if they wanted to.
Yep.
But if they didn't, they all lived happily ever after. Yeah. So they just left it. And it was just, it wasn't so much a finale as it was just the last episode.
Yeah, they
and
didn't leave you hanging, but
sometimes that's okay.
Yeah,
that's what I hope they do. If they do bring the X-Files back, that's why I hope X-Files is like CSI Miami. Like, it's a case, it's a Monster of the Week episode every single week, and they don't bother with the overarching sort of conspiracy stuff, and it's just Monster of the Week every week.
I feel like that's the thing now, though. Yeah. You've got to have this season long. Yeah, you've got to have something like that. It's become more prevalent since X-Files than less, hasn't it?
Maybe, but that's my hope.
Mm. We will see. So, Gary, while we've got you here, I wanted to talk to you about writing, how you broke into journalism, and then how you've made this kind of transition through all these different forms of media as well. Like, what's that journey been like?
I've been really, really, really fortunate in that the two things that I loved growing up as a kid, I got to do them both professionally. I had careers in both. I grew up loving video games, and I grew up loving films. And I left school at 15. I hated school. Couldn't wait to get out. Mm. And the only thing I was ever good at or interested in at school was writing. English was the only thing I ever really enjoyed doing. I was terrible at maths, terrible at everything. I forgot half this. I spent 4 years learning French and German. I don't speak a word of it now.
Yeah.
And I can't remember any of it. So most of what I learned at school went to waste, but I was always very interested in English, and I would write little short stories in school and got a reputation as a bit of an apple polisher for my English teacher because I did extra work just because I enjoyed doing it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't wait to get out, and I was playing video games, and I used to read Commodore User and Zap 64 and these magazines that I used to enjoy. And I started writing my own game reviews, and at 15 got an interview at Commodore User to go and be a freelance game reviewer for them. And I was literally doing my GCSEs in the morning and then going into Commodore User's office and writing game reviews in the afternoon. And as soon as I was done with my exams, I had a staff job at Commodore User. And then from there, worked on a magazine called The One for 16-Bit Games, and then Computer Video Games, what later became CVG, and worked for a long time in the game industry in the UK. Went to Future Publishing, helped launch the original UK version of PC Gamer, and then 3 years later, when they launched an American version, they asked me to come out and kind of look after it.
Oh, cool.
And I did that partly because it seemed like it would be a fun thing to do, like a year in America, but also because I was secretly like what I really wanted to do was write movies. And I thought, well, that will get me that much
closer.
And because it's changed a little bit now, but when I was a kid, it was the idea of writing the kind of stuff that I loved, like Star Wars, Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica, even stupid shit like Knight Rider. You know, I grew up on all the Glenn A. Larson shows, and I loved those shows. And just genre, just fun stuff. And I used to read, you know, Douglas Adams and all kinds of science fiction growing up, and I loved all of it. And I wanted to do that. But beyond like Doctor Who and Blake Seven, there's nothing like that on British. There's a weird kind of snobbery towards it, and still is today, I think. Like, Doctor Who is the number one show that the BBC has. It's their biggest, I think, alongside Top Gear, is like their biggest global export. Yeah. But the reality is, I think the people at the BBC are kind of embarrassed by it. They would much rather be making Wolf Hall and, you know, fancy costume dramas and, you know, what they consider real drama. And I think there's a weird institutional bias towards science fiction and fantasy and anything genre, anything that might actually entertain an audience, is a weird kind of bias against it. And so I thought, well, if I want to make the stuff that I want to make, it's just not going to happen here in the UK. I'd rather just go where that stuff is the norm. So I'll try and break into Hollywood. And so going to America was like half of that. And then I worked on the American version of Total Film magazine for a while. And then what happened was, in the year 2000, there was a big dot-com crash, and a lot of the company I worked for lost a lot of money, laid a ton of people off. And I got some redundancy money, and I had about a year. If I basically just lived on, you know, pot noodles for a year, I could, and like the cheapest, lived as frugally as possible, I could live for about a year without actually having to do any work, like paid work.
That's the dream right there.
Well, it's not quite as glamorous, not quite as fun as you might imagine, sitting around in your underpants eating pot noodles and trying to think of film ideas. But I always said to myself, when I was working in games magazines, I would try to do the film thing as a sideline, but who has the time?
You don't get time, no.
And then suddenly I've got all the time in the world. So I was sitting around, and I thought, okay, well, I had the ideas for films that I wanted to write, but I'd never actually sat down and really done it. And I thought, okay, well, I'll give it a try. And I wrote, over the course of a year, like, I think 5 or 6 different feature film scripts, just as kind of a learning, just like, I'm kind of much more of an autodidact than I am someone who, like, I don't learn very well from books or from being taught things. And I actually think there's a very somewhat disingenuous culture of read this, teachers and books that promise to teach you the formula of writing a hit film, which is all bollocks. A lot of it is nonsense. No one knows the formula to write a hit film. And if they do, trust me, there's much more money to be made writing hit films than there is writing books about how to write hit films. So a lot of these people are complete charlatans and frauds. And I always think that, for me, the best way to learn was just to absorb and consume by osmosis as much as possible. So I would watch a lot of films anyway, read a lot of film scripts, which was hard to do back in the day, because this is before the internet was fully what it is now, and it was hard to find film scripts. Now it's really, really, one of the great advantages is it's really, really easy to go onto the web and find movie scripts of, you know, great movies. You can go find the scripts for all the Oscar movies this year. Like, if your favorite, pick your favorite movie, you can go find it. You can find the script of the book. If you like, you can find all these scripts are out there. And for me, I just read those. I was like, okay, look at what they do and basically try and learn from them. And so I read a lot of scripts and wrote a bunch of my own, and each one was slightly less terrible than the last, until I finally wrote one that was, wouldn't be embarrassed to show someone. And I sent it off to a bunch of agents and managers, and you can find lists that will, resources that will give you lists of people that accept unsolicited queries. Okay. Like, you can't just send your script to CAA. They will send it back to you unopened. They don't just accept scripts from anyone. But there are management companies and producers that are always on the lookout for new material and will read your script. And I sent it to a bunch of those, and there was a management company that liked it and signed me as a writer. And wrote another script after that, which was the first thing that I kind of got optioned by a production company, and then kind of jobbed around for a long time in the kind of the minor leagues of the film writing business, just working on little films. Like, there's a really bad Jason Statham, Jet Li film called War that I worked on, where I wrote some of the dialogue for that. And like, I don't have a credit on the film or anything, because when you come in and like just fix little things, you generally don't. But I did some work on that. Got to hang out with Statham. He gave me a ride in the transporter car. It was brilliant. That was my best story from working on that film.
That's worth it.
That was the good thing that came out of it. And then I wrote Eli as a spec, and we sold that. And then once you sell like an actual film to a studio and it gets someone like Denzel Washington attached, suddenly all these doors that you didn't know existed before open to you, and people want to come and talk to you about working on bigger films. So from that, I got to work. I worked on the Warcraft movie. I worked on Akira, Which I don't think is ever going to be made, but Warner Brothers just keeps trying to make. It's been like six writers on it since me. And I've worked on a bunch of other films. I did the Will Smith movie After Earth, and then Star Wars. And I've been working on, you know, I've also been doing the game stuff as well. It's been really, really interesting that not just kind of going from games and into films. As I kind of transitioned from that, as someone who now is a film writer, but has a legitimate background in video games because I did it for 20 years. Just as I was doing that, we were seeing, because we talked about this earlier, kind of the maturity of games, where now games are trying to figure out how to tell better stories. And so someone coming from a games background who now works in storytelling, people would come to me and say, can you help us do this? So I've worked on a bunch of different video games. Most well-known, probably the first season of The Walking Dead that Telltale did. I was a story consultant on that and wrote one of the five episodes, and that was really well received.
That's a huge thing. Like, everyone loved that. It was like top
of
everyone's
list.
Kind of
a watershed moment, I think, in people. Because Telltale Games, a few years ago, used to be just kind of this scrappy little company that made like Strong, Bad, and Sam & Max games. And now they're one of the biggest developers. You know, they're doing Game of Thrones and Walking Dead, and they're doing a Minecraft, you know, narrative game. And they're this, you know, suddenly they're this huge deal. And that was all off the success of The Walking Dead. And what happened after that was a lot of game companies, I think, woke up to... Again, we talked about this before. Like, back in the day, when a video game came out, you go, well, the story's crappy, but like, who cares? It's a video game. You can't get away with that anymore. If you have a game that has a story and the story's no good, you'll get dinged for that. And rightly so, because the expectation now, for off the back of the work of companies like Naughty Dog and Bungie and BioWare and Telltale, has created a higher expectation for how good a story is told in a video game.
Definitely,
and when a story
is
crappy or story's not there, you miss it now, because we've played other games. And Journey's another game that does beautiful storytelling. So off the back of that, I ended up consulting on a lot of different video games. So it's actually kind of fun for me that I get to do what I like to do now, but in a medium that I still... Because I still play all the games. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to happened.
Have you got any tips for aspiring screenwriters then?
You know, it's really interesting. You know, you were saying earlier, like, you... there's always that question of like, how do you get into the games journalism business? And there's no real way in. Like, you don't go to games journalism school. You know, you just know a lot about games and love them, and hopefully you can write a little bit as well. And, you know, you'd kind of learn the rest along the way. And I think the same is true of film. Like, you can, of course, go to film school. Worked for George Lucas, worked for Brian De Palma and, you know, Spielberg and all these great filmmakers. But for every filmmaker that I know working in the business who went to film school, I know another one who just kind of learned by doing and just made their own films in their back garden and just kind of did it their own way. So there's no, you know, route one into films. I think this is true with any kind of creative endeavor. I mean, J.K. Rowling just wrote, you know, sat in a train station and wrote the Harry Potter books and was rejected by like 30 different publishers. Can you imagine if you're one of the publishers that turned down Harry
Potter?
Horrible,
wouldn't it?
How do you ever live that down?
Yeah.
One of my favorite things to do is to, there's a great website that has all the rejection letters from,
oh wow, awesome.
Like, you know, the record label that turned down U2 and the record label that turned down the Beatles. Like, all those letters still exist.
That's
like the
cool.
Like the famous one, of course, is, you know, the Fred Astaire one. The Fred Astaire audition, where the guy wrote, can't sing, can't dance.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sorry, can't sing, can't act, can dance a little.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be Fred Astaire, so no one knows.
Yeah,
you know?
On that subject, I saw it the other day, John Cleese has it framed in his office, the letter saying, Fawlty Towers, didn't like the script.
Oh, yeah, that's terrible.
It just isn't funny.
Right.
That's what they said.
So, you know, and that, I think, I actually find that great solace when, because every writer goes, I think anyone in any creative field goes through this, you have that sense of like, you're not good enough, and this is going to be terrible, and everyone hates you. You're going to lose, like the Joe Hallenbeck mantra. And it's especially true in writing. When at the beginning of my career, I was very fortunate to meet with and spend a day with Frank Darabont, who's a writing hero of mine.
Yeah.
And I told him, I was just getting started. I hadn't sold anything. And he very kindly, it was really weird what happened was, like, he had done The Mist, I think, and... on a message, I didn't really go on message boards anymore, but I used to back in the day.
Yeah,
and
I was actually just looking at some of your NeoGAF posts about the Star Wars trailers.
Yeah, so I mean, I've basically given all. It's weird. You can't really be a professional
and go on NeoGAF.
Like, you don't see, you know, Simon Kinberg and David Benioff and, you know, Rian Johnson hanging out on message boards very much because you kind of have to put that away when you go become a professional. You can. I mean, there are. Aaron Sorkin used to go on and like get into flame wars with people, and so. You know, if you more power to you, but like for me, it just became like I again, who has the time? But so I used to be on this film message board, and people were kind of ragging on The Mist. And I wrote back and said, my comment was like, but this is the guy who made The Shawshank. Like, you can't really give Frank Darabont too much, even if he made a film that's not that great.
Yeah.
This is like, you only, if you made just one film that great, you're good forever.
Forever.
Like someone, like someone did a thing the other day on one of the websites that was, if you look at all of George Lucas, all of Lucasfilm's other films, other than Star Wars and Indiana Jones, they're not really that great. Like Willow, Radioland Murders, Red Tails. And like, there aren't really many other like really great films that Lucasfilm made.
Okay.
But I made the point, that's like saying, what has Jonas Salk ever done besides cure polio? Like, once you've created Star Wars and Indiana Jones, you're pretty much good. For, like, that, you don't have to make anything else. You're pretty much good for the rest of your life. Yeah. You've contributed more than enough. And so I made the same point about The Shawshank Redemption. And then I got this weird private message from Frank Darabont saying, I don't post on that board, but I do lurk, and I just wanted to say I appreciated your comment. Thank you very much.
You must have thought it was a wind-up.
No, no, no. It genuinely was... I can't remember. He wrote something that I was like, this is the real guy.
Yeah.
Now, when you're a writer trying to break in, you will jam your finger into any little crack that opens that you think. And so I wrote back saying, hey, I really appreciate that. I'm an aspiring writer. If you have any advice for me. And he said, come to my house, and I'll talk to you about writing. I was like, this is brilliant. So I went to Frank Darabont's house, and he was a lovely, lovely man.
Yeah.
And I sat with him for a bit. And I remember saying to him, actually, no, I can't tell you that part because that's super secret. But but I remember saying to him, talking about the terror of the blank page. Like when you're trying to sit down and create something and you look at the blank page, and that's when that voice starts up. You're terrible. You can't write. Everyone's going to hate this.
Yeah.
You're an imposter. Everyone's going to realize that you're a fraud. And he said, yeah, I know, it's terrible, isn't it? And I was like, wait, hold on a minute. That you wrote The Shawshank Redemption. He was like, yeah, it never goes away.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter what you've done. The next script that I sit down and write, I'll go through the exact same process. You're a fraud. People are going to realize that you just got lucky that one time.
Yeah.
And it's a real thing. It's called imposter syndrome. And I remember thinking, like, at the time, I don't know if that makes me feel better or worse, that even the best and most accomplished people in the industry go through it.
Yeah.
Or... that's kind of depressing to think, no matter how much you accomplish, you'll always be haunted by that. But I actually think it's what keeps you honest. The fact that the voice that's telling you, you're going to suck and no one's going to like this next thing. Like, I've got this book coming out. I promise I'm not playing, but they have this book coming out and I'm terribly, terribly nervous about it because what if people don't like it? And you make yourself, every time you have a film, I went through this with Eli, I went through it with After Earth. I'm sure, with Star Wars down the road, like every time you contributed to something creatively, you put yourself out there and you make yourself vulnerable in a way that you don't do in any other field. And I actually came to look at my years as a critic very differently because I have a very, very, once you've seen how the sausage is made and how much hard work goes into the creation of something, I came to have a very different view of like how criticism works.
Definitely,
and I have very little time for I have a lot of time for like informed criticism. And I think that people that write good analysis of like films or games or whatever contribute something to the culture and they help us come to a better understanding of the medium and they help make films better and games better. But I have no time at all for like the drive-by snark of the internet where people just take kind of take cheap pot shots at things and move on. Like when people say, oh, I could have made a better movie than that. Really?
Do it then.
Honestly, try it. Even a mediocre film is really, really hard to make. And it's actually a minor miracle when a good film is made. It's really, really hard. And so that idea that never goes away is what keeps you honest. And I've been to writing conventions and the people that come up to me and like, oh, I've written this thing, but like, I don't know if it's any good. I'm like, there's a good chance it is good. Cause the fact that you've got that voice at the back of your head constantly telling you it's not good is what's making you work harder. It's when the guy comes up to you and says, I've written a script and this is the dog's bollocks. And you don't need to change a word of it. It's the best script ever written. I guarantee you that script is probably crap. And that guy is not going to work in the business at all because
he doesn't have that voice.
It's also just the idea that I guarantee once your script goes into the Hollywood system, it's going to get pulled apart, torn apart. You're going to get 50 pages of notes.
Yeah.
And if you're not able to deal with that, as many writers aren't, you're not going to last 5 minutes in that business. So I'm still haunted by that idea of I'm terrible, I'm going to suck. But I think like if you look at writers who are, I remember Russell T. Davies, a Doctor Who guy, and most accomplished writers, when you look at Louis C.K., we just did a big interview about this, that everyone that you look up to, I want to be like that guy, will tell you the same thing. Yeah, we're all terrified of failure all the time. And that is, in fact, the thing that drives you to do your best work.
Amazing.
I don't know if I even answered the question there. I went off on such a tangent.
No, yeah. I think that's good.
One specific tip you gave to me, though, was to read unmade scripts.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really good idea because I do find myself reading scripts, but because they're films you know and love, you know what's coming next, and so you're not thinking about it in those terms. Whereas I guess if you don't know, if it's something you've never read and never seen before, then you're thinking more about the structure and understanding more about what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, it's. I mean, there's two ways to do it. I mean, I still need to send you that list, actually.
It's 25, isn't it?
Yeah, so I have like 20... When people ask me, like, what would you recommend I read?
Yeah.
Like, because I want to be a screenwriter. Like, what books or whatever? I said, don't read books. Read scripts. Read what a good script is. And you'll just, hopefully, through osmosis, just learn what works and what doesn't.
Yeah.
And there's like a list I've got of like 20 scripts, some of which have been made, some of which haven't been made.
Mm. Send that over to
It's interesting to look at. Again, you can read the scripts to a film that you've seen and love, and it's fascinating to look at the difference between what was on the page and then what was made. But if you want to get a sense of like how a script really works, because again, a script isn't the finished product. It's a blueprint. It's meant to give you a sense of what the finished film can be. And in the course of 110, 120 pages, and as few words as possible, you have to, for a director, for an actor, for all the people that are going to make the film, evoke and paint in their mind as much of a picture of what the film is and can be. And that's really, really hard. So watching a film and then reading the script is interesting, but you won't... Your read of the script is going to be prejudiced by the fact that you saw the film.
Yeah.
And whatever imagery, like if you read the script to Die Hard, that's a great script to read, but you're going to see Bruce Willis running around in your head. If you read the script, like read a great unproduced script, and there's a number of ones that I could recommend, there's nothing for you to fall back on. Like however much of the sense of a film, like a great script you're reading, you were like, I feel like I saw the movie.
Yeah.
But if you already saw the movie, you don't get a real way to get at that. But if you just read a great script for a film you haven't seen, and at the end of it, you're like, wow, that felt like watching the film. That's a great script.
Okay.
And those are the ones that I would recommend that people read. Maybe as an addendum to this, I'll come up with a list with some links, and you can put it on the website, and people can go click on links and read some
that'd
great
be fantastic,
unproduced scripts.
That'd be really good.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
Great.
Good stuff.
Good advice there. Right, we should power through some of this now, Gav.
Sorry, have I been going on a little bit?
No, it's good.
Well. No, it's been very interesting. But there's a couple of interesting emails here. I have one from Colin Fares, again on the TV shows that he likes to come back. His first would be The Crystal Maze.
I love The Crystal Maze.
Especially if Richard O'Brien came back.
It'd have to be
Richard
O'Brien. He's another one that doesn't age, right? He doesn't get older.
Yeah, he's always looked like that.
He would be good. I would actually go back even further. Do you remember The Adventure Game? You're probably not old enough to remember that. Some of our older listeners will remember The Adventure Game. It used to be on like at tea time on the BBC.
Okay.
And the idea was like these celebrities of the time, like whoever was on Blue Peter at the time or whatever, and like four other guys would get transported to this alien world. And the alien culture, it was this whole narrative, much like The Crystal Maze, where this alien race, they liked to test humans and they liked to play games and do puzzles. And the idea was like, could you solve all these puzzles? It was very similar to The Crystal Maze, but it's kind of a precursor to it. But I'd love to see both of those come back.
And Nightmare is another suggestion that he says.
Nightmare was another show like that, right?
Exactly like
that. That has sort of come back in the last couple of years.
Yeah, they've done it live on stage in London, which I went to see. But but with modern day effects, as Colin says, they'd look great. He's also a big Stargate SG-1 fan. He'd love to see that come back. I never really watched it, so I can't
never
really comment.
Never saw it,
I've got a couple. So, I've got Green Wing, which was Tamsin Green, Seema Mangan.
Yeah.
A really good comedy. And, it's really good to go watch those old comedies before. Like, I watched Big Train quite a lot. And it's interesting going back and watching, like, Simon Pegg as, like, a 30-year-old, like, being funny and things. I think that's quite good. That's a good one.
Have I got any more here?
I've got one from... Yep. Aaron Sorkin's Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which I actually really, really liked.
I'm a little bit of a Sorkin fanboy in that. Even what's considered his worst work, I still think it's better than most of what was on television.
Yeah.
The Steve Jobs script that he wrote is fantastic.
Oh, wow,
it's the best thing I've read talking about like scripts where you read the script and you feel like you've seen the movie.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, okay, that's fantastic.
The first picture of that dropped online today, actually.
It did?
It was an unofficial one, but it was interesting to see what they looked like.
I'm very interested to see that film.
Yeah, definitely. But I thought Studio 60 was a really, really good show. And it has a couple of absolute stinker episodes. But it had a really, really good ending, unfortunately.
I found it a bit too melodramatic. Like,
It's really heavy-handed. Like,
I think, you know, Sorkin gets criticized a lot because he has like certain rhythms and tricks that he uses over and over in each show. You know, it's like, oh, okay, there's that episode again.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
There's really certain things that he likes to revisit. But I just find, again, like when The West Wing was at its best, it was better than anything else on television.
He's amazing. That's quite a lengthy defense of Mrs. Brown's Boys. Yeah. I'm not sure if you want to read it or not.
I saw that you put Mrs. Brown's Boys, and I'm just saying I'm just not even going to read it.
But I think it should be allowed that someone should defend it because we've slated it. And I did say it's the most popular sitcom in the UK right now.
I've never even seen it. It's very popular, right?
Yeah, sorry, Carl Barrett, who sent us that impassioned defense. Yeah. But finally, this is quite interesting, actually. This is a totally different subject. Mm. This is from... what's he called? He's called himself two different things here.
Brian Mack.
Jiminy Jellicas.
Okay.
That's what he seems to want to be known as.
Jiminy Jellicas, isn't that what Fallout Boy says? It's radioactive man sidekick.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Then this is something I've had a couple of tweets about this as well. So read Ghostbusters. Jiminy says, all the talk seems to be about females, etc., and whether you are sexist if you don't agree with it. I'd like to know your thoughts more on the reasoning behind the move by Sony. It doesn't make sense to me to move in a direction that a large part of the hardcore fans will feel alienated by. Do you think they aren't worried by the original fans' dislike and think that the success of Bridesmaid will attract enough fan viewers to cover this loss? So I've seen people saying that they think that this move, having Paul Feig write and direct it and have it all females, means that they're just aiming the film at the Bridesmaid audience. But I think that's really wrong. Not looking at the stuff he's done in the past, particularly Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah.
Like, just because he's made two successful films that have had women in the lead.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with this at all.
I don't have a problem with it at all because the original cast don't want to come back for it. One of them's dead. Bill Murray doesn't want to do it. Yeah. How else do you do it? Who would you cast?
Yeah.
Like, you go in a completely different way that then they can't be compared in the same way. If you've got a female cast, it can't be compared in the same way.
I have to say, I have nothing but disdain for this attitude and this argument.
It's foul.
When did it be? I mean, I guess it's just been this way forever. But I was going to say, when did it become the norm? Because it's always been the norm that the male is just considered the default, and you have to flip a switch for it to become something else, as opposed to just saying, "Well, it can be this or that at the beginning."
Yeah.
And what's funny? Who do we want to put in this movie? It doesn't matter if they're male or female.
Exactly.
What makes it fresh? What makes it different? Like, because are you saying that because the original Ghostbusters was all male that alienates women? Like, women didn't like the original Ghostbusters because it was all dudes.
Yep.
Like, it's absolutely nonsensical. We've got to grow out of this. It's pathetic.
The only thing that I'm worried about is they're saying it's a reboot. I kind of wish it was in the same universe, though, where
I hope it
this
is.
Stuff happened in the 80s. I mean, we don't really know at this point. But I would like it to... This stuff had happened in the 80s, and this is what's happening now. And, you know.
I mean, again, who knows? I think Paul Feig is a genius, and Freaks and Geeks is a fantastic show. Yeah. My instinct on it would be, acknowledge the films that were made and say that this is the next generation and they're picking up where those guys left off.
Yeah.
I don't... If it's a reboot... I mean, who knows?
Who knows? All I know is these women are really funny as well.
Yeah.
And they're mainly Saturday Night Live alumni, like just like the original guys.
Like the original.
Which is great.
We've got one final piece of feedback from a friend of yours.
A friend of mine?
Yes.
I don't have any friends.
A friend of yours called David Upchurch.
Oh, I know Dave. Well, I used to, from back in the day. He's still a friend.
So he's given us a story then, which we...
Go on.
The story's fairly simple.
Wait, did you tell David that I was going to be on the show?
We did, yeah.
I think Alex did.
So you've stitched me up, basically.
Alex did. Nothing to do with me. I'm just reading it. The story's fairly simple. Gaz and I were with a crowd in the City Pride, as usual. So what's the City Pride?
That's a pub that we used to drink in. It was right next door to EMAP, where we used to work on the old 8-bit and 16-bit magazines. Yeah.
Do you want us to do this story?
Well, I don't know.
Is the Star Wars quiz one that we sort of mentioned?
Oh, no, that's fine. Okay.
Okay, good. That's what we...
Put you at ease a little
bit. That's fine.
And as usual, arguing about Star Wars. And we decided to have a Star Wars face-off Smackdown trivia challenge. Is that the official name for it?
I remember it very well. It haunts me to this day.
So we took it in turns to ask each other questions. And after a long, bloody battle, I stumped him. Do you remember what the question was that he stumped you with?
The question was, what is Biggs's surname?
Okay.
And I didn't know. Because it's one of those things that you don't get... It's not in the films. Like, you have to read the books and know all the ancillary material to know that. And I didn't know it, and he finally got me. But, I mean, you know, we... we escalate. It started off like fairly easy, and you get harder and harder as you go. Yeah. And eventually, he won. But I'd just like to say, if David wants a rematch, I guarantee you,
we'll host it on
I guarantee
this.
You, I would not lose today because I have upped my Star Wars game considerably in the years since.
Yeah. So when Gary comes back,
maybe we'll get David in
2 years' time for the podcast. We'll do a Star Wars quiz.
Years ago, I've got to tell you this story because that one makes me look bad. I tell you a Star Wars story, it makes me look good. Actually, it doesn't. It makes me look terrible, but whatever.
Yeah.
So years ago, my girlfriend, I'm going back, 15 years, but obviously been a Star Wars fan for much longer than that. And my girlfriend at the time knew that I was a big Star Wars fan. And for Christmas one year, I was visiting, it was the first time visiting her family. I spent Christmas at her family's house. And they didn't know it's like, what do we get Gary? We don't know what to buy, get him for Christmas. What does he like? She said, well, he likes Star Wars. So they bought me Star Wars Trivial Pursuit. Okay. And so like after dinner, it's like, you got to get the board game out and we'll all play.
Of course,
it.
Yeah.
And it's me and my girlfriend at the time and her parents and brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and like a lot of people sitting around playing. So we get out the game and there's six of us playing and the questions are not super easy. And again, to the average person, like the average man on the street who can tell you who Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker is, but doesn't necessarily know the difference between an X-Wing and a Y-Wing. It was aimed at people that at least knew the difference between an X-Wing and a Y-Wing.
Yeah.
And so I was the last to go. We ran around the table and everyone was like, "What? How am I supposed to know what the Emperor's name is? Because it's not in the films." And so they went around, like, people increasingly saying, like, who knows this stuff? Like, who would know any of these questions? And it came to me and I ran the table and got all six cheeses and won the game in one turn because I knew every answer. And I was so happy. And I remember looking up at my quite possibly at the time future in-laws that were all just looking at me and like just
disgust.
Like, not impressed at all.
No,
just like,
yeah.
What have you done with your life that this is what you know? Like, you shouldn't know this much. So they were kind of appalled and the relationship went south very quickly after that. But I think that story makes me look good.
Yeah.
But to the average man in the street, they probably would not be impressed.
No, and I hope you weren't celebrating in their faces.
Oh, yeah. I was sort of like, your face, suckers. Like, cool. Flip the whole table over and walked out, dropped the mic.
Yeah.
So we're definitely some Star Wars trivia in 2 years' time.
I'll do a Star Wars trivia rematch against pretty much anybody.
Okay.
Except the guys at Lucasfilm,
okay,
whose job it is to know everything. Like, if you want to, there's a couple of guys who work at Lucasfilm who are like the keepers of the canon.
Amazing.
And like, if there was like a life or death Star Wars pub trivia, and you needed like a ringer,
I can give you a couple of names
that would just blow everybody away.
I think we should do a competition to find the ultimate Star Wars fan.
Bring him in.
Yeah, bring him in. Take Gary. Yeah.
Let's do it.
Cool. Finally, let's power through games and films coming out this week. So,
Evolve is out next Tuesday. It's very good.
We had a podcast on it last week.
Yeah, so if you want to hear more about that, go back to that. Game of Thrones Episode 2 is out. So it's one of the Telltale films. Yeah, it's really, really good. And my favourite game that's out at the moment is called Gunman Clive 2.
What's that?
On 3DS. It's this little indie game, Gunman Clive.
You're on the eShop?
You can get it on that. I think it costs about £2.50. and it's just brilliant.
And it's the sequel to Gunman Clive, I assume.
Right, yeah. Which has this amazing little, amazing art style to it. There's more colours in this one. I think there was like two colours in the first one. And it just uses 3DS perfectly. And it's £2.50.
Can't go wrong, can you?
Yeah, exactly.
It's less than a cup of coffee.
Exactly.
On the film side of things, if you've got kids, Shaun the Sheep is out, and I'm hearing very good things about the Shaun
the Sheep
movie.
Is Ant-Man still as good as they were like in the classic days?
Well, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Pirates was amazing.
Yeah, Pirates was really good. I believe this one is aimed a little bit younger.
Okay.
It might not even have any human dialogue or very little dialogue in it.
All right.
So, but yeah, hearing it's really good.
Good.
They're very funny films. That, like the shorts they released on the 3DS, the Shaun the Sheep ones, were really, really funny. Like good sort of like physical comedy.
Very
film.
Funny. Yeah. Like, the spoof posters they've done have been quite funny.
Really good, yeah.
Yeah, they did a Boyhood spoof poster where it was Shaun lying back and it was Baha Hood. Wow.
They did a Big Hero 6 one as well, which might have been Bar Hero 6, to be honest.
It was really good. They never did anything better than The Wrong Trousers, though, did they? I mean, that is the pinnacle, I think, still to
amazing
this day.
Amazing stuff.
So good.
This week we've also got Selma coming out, which I've seen, the Martin Luther King movie. Yeah. Very, very powerful. Really worth a watch. Very upsetting. But two and a half hours.
Oscars time's got to be, isn't it?
Yeah, 2.5 hours, though. That's really. I learned a lot watching that movie.
Okay.
I don't know how much of it was true, but the Interview's finally coming out in the UK.
Okay.
It's getting a bit of a limited release, but it disappeared from the UK schedule.
Yeah.
Did you see that when it was...
No, I haven't seen it, although it is on Netflix. It's just got added to Netflix. So when I get back, I'll have a chance to see it. I mean, it's obviously very silly what happened with that film. And of course, it ended up probably getting more attention than it would have. I think definitely, it probably just would have came and went based on just the merits of the film.
It got more attention, but I think it made less money because it was just on so few screens.
Yes. I mean, I think Sony will end up losing money on it, but I mean, it's obviously, I thought it was kind of sad what happened.
Scary.
Agreed. And I've seen it. I mean, it's quite funny.
Yeah.
It's not as funny as This Is the End, but enjoyable, and it just seems crazy that it caused all that.
Yeah.
And I guess the big one coming out this week is Jupiter Ascending, the new one from the Wachowskis.
So that's embargoed until Monday, isn't it? People have seen it, but no one's talking about it yet.
I saw a review today. I'm sure.
Did you? Well, I haven't seen
Little White
it.
Lies have put theirs up, I think.
Okay. Yeah. We weren't invited to see it till tomorrow, so I don't really know what to say. It's never a good sign when a film's put back a year and you're embargoed until the day before or something. But
yeah, it's not good.
We don't know. I like the Wachowskis. I hope it's good. It's just...
This is another thing, going back to the idea of like snark, and there's a terrible kind of poisonous undercurrent of negativity on the internet these days that I try to kind of stay away from. And it's really interesting that someone made this point the other day that there's a lot of people out there that almost seem to be rooting for that
something
film
to fail.
And I think when you root for a film to fail, you root for film to fail. Like, I don't get it. We just want to earlier about how rare it is to see big original science fiction films being made. Yeah. Chris Nolan and the Wachowskis are pretty much the only guys left that are able to kind of get a big original science fiction films through the Hollywood system at a big budget and present big, brave ideas. I mean, look at what The Matrix. The Matrix is an incredible piece of filmmaking, and that was an original film that they struggled. 99% of other alternate universes, that film never gets made.
Yeah.
So why in a world of, you know, sequels and remakes and reboots and adaptations where we're so desperately saying, why can't we have more original films? Yeah. When one comes along, people just instantly want to pile on. I don't understand the attitude at all.
Yeah, no.
If the film is no good, then fair enough, but we don't know that. I just don't understand. Like, why wouldn't your default
give it a chance,
attitude... Why, if you're a film lover, why wouldn't your default mode to be hopeful and optimistic about every single film that comes out? Why wouldn't you hope that every single film that comes out is good, as opposed to just assuming it's going to be crap?
I don't
understand the attitude at all.
Just keep an open mind, people.
Yep.
And shall we end it there?
Let's do it.
On a positive note.
I want to thank Gary for coming in and spending all this time with us. This has been a epically long podcast.
Yeah. So I warned you it might. Back in the US where I do the Tested podcast, they typically run for like 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone will complain. It was all very interesting, wasn't it?
I've learned a lot. Is it been 2 days?
2 days. But Abomination, let's say that again.
Oh, yes.
That's coming out pre-sale on February the 9th, I believe.
Yeah, so this goes out on the Friday. So if you listen to this on the Friday or over the weekend, on the Monday, February 9th, you'll be able to go to a website called inkshares.com, InkSharees.
Okay.
Or you can follow me on Twitter, Gary Witter, GaryWhitta. Or you can follow the hashtag Abomination, and all of those things will be... This, like I said, kind of self-published, so there's no big publisher or studio on this one going out and doing all the... or rattling the cages to get the word out. It's really just me.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of shamelessly promoting it guerrilla style as much as I can, which I'm very glad to be here today.
Yeah.
Follow it. So go to Inkshares or follow me on Twitter or follow the hashtag Abomination, and you will be in a position to order the book. No, it's really good. So I actually haven't told anyone this. This is really cool. So this is what you'll see on Monday. So it's a little bit crowdfunded. Mm. But instead of like on Kickstarter, where you get like a million different options, like you can get £5, £10 or whatever, you can do all these different things. There's 3 different ways to do it. You can either buy an ebook just on its own, which I think is like $8. I don't know what this is going to translate into.
Yeah.
Or you can get a limited edition hardcover of the book that I will sign, which you can only get during the... Once those pre-orders close, you won't be able to get that anymore. And an ebook, because shouldn't all books come with an ebook? I don't understand why you don't get that automatically. Or if you want to be a bit nutty, you can spend $100 and get 3 copies of the book and an ebook and actually get your name in the book. We're going to however many of those are available.
Yeah.
Once they're all done, I think it's like however many people can pre-order it.
Mm.
Once it hits its crowdfunding number, whoever bought the book at that level in the front or the back of the book, someone will get their name in the book. So that's nice as well.
So
nice.
Many options.
Yeah. So it's by Grabthar's hammer. What a savings.
So thank you so much for giving us your time, Gary, and chatting for such a long time.
I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Yeah.
And thank you guys for listening and watching. And next week, I think we have another special guest.
We do.
But you know what? I don't want to say it.
No.
Give me a clue.
I think people should go and watch Rebel Base, your Star Wars show, because they'll find out in there where
ooh, I know who it is now. I'm not going to say that.
Why don't you do a clue?
Yeah. much like Mark Millar, someone from the world of comics whose work I very much admire.
Nice. Excellent. So check out Rebel Base if you want to find out who it is, or just tune in next week. But for now, thank you for watching.
Thank you.
Cheerio.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.